we're in the midst of a number of things. It feels like a storm of activity, but it's nothing like Oklahoma County, which is described as Tornado Alley. It has experienced four tornadoes, and in some ways, my mind and my life feels that way, but it is nothing in comparison to those who've actually lost homes and loved ones. And Oklahoma County has experienced four giant tornadoes, two being an EF5 twister that killed over 40 people in 1999, and another 24 people just this past week. I don't know if you've been up on the news, but it's been a tragic loss of life and property in Oklahoma. Now, the National Weather Service has been issuing alerts for days ahead of the latest storm, and it was quoted as saying, "As much as any place on earth, folks who live there in Oklahoma County know what severe weather alerts mean." Isn't that true? Still, the largely conservative state so far has resisted government imposing requirements that new homes or schools come equipped with storm shelters. Only 2.5% of homes in Oklahoma County were equipped with storm-safe shelters. Isn't that interesting? After knowing that they live in Storm Alley, it was these shelters that kept the death toll relatively low. This is what the people have been saying. Now, U.S. Representative Tom Cole, whose district includes the area hit by the tornado, was quoted as saying, "We're going to have this discussion as a state as well as our community." In other words, we need to heed the warnings. We need to start thinking about instituting some help in terms of saying we need shelters during this, in preparation of these terrible storms. It happens year after year. Now, some time ago, I did something I hadn't done in a very long time. I listened to the airline attendant as she gave her warnings. I normally tune her out, and how many of you hang on to every single word that comes out of his or her mouth while you're getting into the plane? I'm pretty sure none of you do. I know I don't. And I know that I'm not alone now. Like many of us, I usually start reading a book or a magazine and I ignore his or her cautions, right? But this time I didn't. This time I didn't because I was in Colombia, South America, and we were flying from the capital of Bogota and we were going into the Chocó region on the west coast of the country, and it was dense jungle area, and we were heading into the heart of the rebel and paramilitary territory, and the ongoing 50-year civil war had not quite finished. It was relatively quiet, but it wasn't finished yet. And a few thoughts went through my head as we took off. I was thinking to myself, "Oh, I'm sure glad I've updated my life insurance." Another thought was, "I'm glad I had a chance to say goodbye to my loved ones, my family, my kids, my wife, and my church family." And then my last thought was, "God, would you please keep us from getting shot down?" Now, were those absurd kinds of thoughts that were going through my mind? Perhaps. But thoughts that weren't beyond the realm of possibility, and so they were going through my mind nonetheless. So I listened as the airline attendant held up a seatbelt, and I went through the instructions, and I buckled myself in. And as she described the oxygen mask that would pop up in front of me if there were a pressure loss, I looked up to see where it was stored. And when she pointed to the exit doors, I actually turned to find them. And that's when I noticed, as I stood up and kind of looked around to look at the exit doors, I noticed for the first time something that she or he notices every single time in every single flight. Nobody was listening. No one was paying attention. And I was shocked. I was like, "Really? Is this really what they go through? And they do this every single time?" I seriously wondered what would happen if I stood up and I got everybody's attention by shouting, "Listen up! One accident and this plane goes down." You know, what's being demonstrated could actually save our lives. I didn't do that. But I wondered what would happen if the attendant used more drastic means. Like, what if she took a gasoline-drenched doll and lit it on fire? And what if the in-flight screen portrayed images of desperate people just clamoring for the exits and trying to deplane as fast as they could? You know, have you ever noticed that the warning videos always show people smiling throughout the tragedies that they're going through? You know, the thing is popping off and they're like smiling as they put their air mask on, and they're smiling as they put it on their kid. What if she marched up and down the aisles and yanked away the newspapers and magazines from people and said, "You know what, You need to listen if you want to survive this flaming tin can. Well, obviously she would lose her job, right? But she would be doing us all a favor, because love cautions the loved. And the book of Micah is a warning. In fact, it is a caution. God's prophet warns of the terrible judgment which awaits all who ignore God. Be prepared, he pleads, and then he explains how to prepare. And we're going to talk about that for a moment. Now, Micah prophesied during the reigns of the Judean kings Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And basically, it was a period covering over 55 years. Micah's home was in Moresheth, about 25 miles southwest of Jerusalem. But his preaching most likely took place in that capital city during a very turbulent time in Judah's history. At almost 750 BC, that's 750 years before Christ, the mighty empire of Assyria was seizing control of the whole realm, and Judah and Jerusalem were just about to be destroyed. Now, large sections of the Hebrew population were deported as they took over, and that's what they did. As they took over places, they would deport people and move them into different parts of the kingdom as a way of kind of subjugating these people and saying, you are ours. You have no control over your lives. We are your masters now. And so that's what they would do. Judah lost 46 of her surrounding cities. Northern Israel was swallowed up, so the kingdom of Israel now was gone. And Jerusalem was saved only by Hezekiah's payment of a large tribute to Assyria, which included gold, even from the temple. It is against this background of war, loss, and devastation that Micah's message then alternates between oracles of judgment and salvation. Now, the book of Micah begins and ends with the nations. You'll find that in chapter 1, verse 2, and chapter 7, verse 16. Everything is set against the background of God's promise to Israel's forebears to bring blessing on all the families of the earth through Israel. And you'll find that in Genesis 12 and then Micah 7. The question behind the book of Micah is this: how can God use Israel as the medium of his blessing on all the nations when Israel is so terribly sinful? Judah is shot through with oppression of the poor. There are corrupt courts and judges, and there are dishonest commercial practices. We kind of mentioned that from Amos last week. There was lots of false prophecy going on, and there were greedy priests. So the pastors of the time, they were just wanting to grab as much as they could. There was loss of communal order, and there was disobedience of God's justice and commandments. So how can such a nation be the instrument of God? That's Micah's question. And the answer is that God will first judge Israel, giving her up to Assyria. So Assyria comes and Israel falls. And then he will save a remnant of the people and will give them a future Davidic king, which is the Messiah, the promised one, the anointed one, Jesus, who comes to rule over them. And that's prophesied in chapter 5. Now, you'll go to today's passage. If you haven't taken the time to already do that, I just invite you to open your Bibles or your pew Bibles that are in front of you to today's portion of Scripture. You want to go to Micah 6, verses 1 to 8. Now, by the time we get to this passage, God has allowed Israel to be taken over by Assyria. And the people begin calling out, saying, this is just terrible. You have our attention now, God. How long are we going to suffer in this misery? What did we do to deserve this? Those are kind of the exclamations that Israel is coming out with. And the passage is written as a court case between the Lord and his covenant people. And the Lord is the plaintiff, the one with the complaint, and Israel stands as the accused. And the mountains, the hills, the foundations of the earth serve as the witnesses or jury, and you'll find that in verses 1 and 2. Now at the moment, Israel is complaining, and thank you so much, Oki, for that wonderful rendition, that wonderful reading in Korean. What does it take for God to come to Israel's rescue, they say? Isn't it interesting that we seem to only invoke God in times of our trouble, when we're going through struggles of our own, crises? And Israel asks, does he want burnt offerings or calves a year old that are so much more valuable than newborns? Would God be satisfied with thousands of rams like Solomon offered? Or would literal rivers of precious olive oil used for food and healing be okay? Or perhaps, maybe, like the sarcastic literal defense lawyer says, God would prefer child sacrifice that was forbidden in the law? Perhaps you'd like that, God, even though you condemned that. What will it take to make you happy, they say. You'll find that in Jeremiah 7. And this is Israel's exasperated question. Well, Micah turns everyone's attention back to verses 4 and 5, and I want to direct your attention to those verses now. Israel has forgotten God's saving deeds in the past. God tells her of his redemption out of slavery in Egypt, his gift of the law through Moses, of atonement through the priest of Aaron, and he reminds them once again of guidance through the prophetess Miriam. The people have forgotten God's deliverance from the curse of Balak and Balaam, and they've forgotten his guidance of them through the Jordan from Shittim to their first encampment in Gilgal. In other words, God calls his people to remember. So many times in the scriptures, Israel and we are commanded to remember. If you go to Deuteronomy 24, you'll see the passage up on the screen. It says this, "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there." And that remembrance of the Lord's mercy becomes the basis of our mercy toward others. And you'll find that in Luke chapter 24, verse 6. "Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and on the third day rise." And that remembrance helps the women at the tomb realize that their Lord has risen from the dead. So here in this passage from Micah, Israel is told to remember God's saving acts toward her in the past. Verse 5. Both to indict her, to say, hey, you have not remembered. To say, hey, you have an impatient attitude toward God. You've got to change that attitude. Psalm 103. Verse 2 says this, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits." Forget not all his benefits. It is absolutely essential that we remember what God has done for us, both as individuals and as a church or a society or a nation, for several reasons, and I'm just going to give you three. The first one is this. Memory of God's acts on our behalf informs the basis of gratitude. We need to remember all of the marvelous things that God has done. As Psalm 103 has it, he has forgiven us, he has guided us, he has showered on us mercy, and at times healed us and heaped upon us benefits, both large and small. Gratitude for all that lifts us out of our bubble of self-concern and leads us to thankfulness. At least we hope that. Gratitude is the cure for many problems, because if we are thankful, we won't feel as grumpy or filled with despair. We cannot remain tuned inward on our own interests when we turn outward in thankfulness to God. So gratefulness and gratitude is the first reason. The second one is this. It's hope. Memory of God's saving acts form the basis of our hope for the future. And the scriptures record God's mighty acts toward his people. And it gives us assurance that he will never desert us, he will never forsake us, and that our future lies secure in his hands. We have to remember that. God, throughout the story of Israel, always kept his promises, and that should give us hope. And on the basis of his faithfulness in the past, we know with confidence that he will be faithful to his promises to us in the future. He will always be with us. He will bring that good work that he began in us to its completion. He will bring in his kingdom on earth, even as it is heaven. And he will give us eternal life in that kingdom. Now, if we remember, we will face the future with confidence. Finally, remembrance of God's saving deeds in the past gives us patience in the midst of difficulty. We may be suffering, and all around us may seem dark with no way out of what we're going through. I mean, there are tornadoes in Oklahoma. There are health crises here in Vancouver, and there are relationship problems, financial worry right within our congregation. God acted for us in the past, and God has rescued us before. And so we will wait patiently for a salvation in His good timing. Isaiah 40:31 says this, "They who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles, and they shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." Perhaps the words of Paul, our fellow sufferer, are most helpful here. He says this in Romans 8, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glory that is to be revealed." God's final salvation is coming, and we remember that the salvation that He is providing us has been promised, and so we need to wait, and we will wait in patience. And so to conclude His court case, God reminds His people in verse 8 that the people have forgotten God's words. And God has commanded His people to observe three things, and thank you, Ruth, for covering these things: to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with Him. And we're just going to close with these three. And I'm going to give you a little bit of an explanation of these three as well, because as we translate it from the Hebrew, there's a little bit of meaning lost in here. To act justly means to act justly, but justice in this context signifies God's order for the whole of life. So it does include legal justice, but its meaning is much, much more broader than that. To do justice is to order every area of life in accordance with God's will. So that covers everything. How we treat others, how we talk to others, how we respond to others, especially when they are lippy or give us attitude or they're having a bad day and we want to just honk at them because they're cutting in line. Or acting justly covers more than just legal justice. It's covering all of life. Let's move to love mercy. Now, love sometimes is translated here as kindness, maybe loving kindness, or just mercy as we have in the TNIV, but it's missing something here because it is actually a covenant concept, and we've talked about that before. And covenant concept means to be faithful to one's relationship with God and to be faithful with one's relationship to one's community. That's what this is talking about here. To be bound together in solidarity with them and to be a faith family that lives in steadfast loyalty to God and to other human beings. And the interesting thing here is when Micah is using this word covenant love, he knows that we're going to screw up. And yet God's going to still uphold His end of the bargain. It's not a contract. Fine, we mess up. Okay, contract's broken. Deal's off. That's not what God is saying here. He says, despite the fact that you're going to mess up, I'm still going to hold up my end of the bargain. So why don't you mirror that in your walk? Why don't you love mercy? Why don't you walk with loving covenant love, faithful love, and demonstrate that to others as I've demonstrated that to you? Finally, Israel is told that she is expected to walk humbly with God. But the Hebrew verb here means much more than simply to walk modestly or in a lowly manner, almost a self-deprecating kind of walk, or self-effacingly. That's not what it really means. Here it includes the meaning of to walk attentively, to paying attention to, or to walk while you're watching. You know, if you don't watch your step, you're going to trip. Some of us have done that before. In short, Israel is to pay attention to God's will and not her own. Israel is to watch God for what is good and not make up her own goals. She is to be attentive always to a relationship with God and not to be a follower of her own ways. And if Israel will do that, she will demonstrate a faithful covenant love. And she will do justice in all walks of life. So walking attentively to God's will allows faithful covenant love and justice to happen. It is these three requirements that Israel has failed to carry out. And so the implication is that she stands guilty in this court case with God. So in closing, as we read Micah, remember that he has words that serve to warn. Let us remember that we as individuals and as a community, as a nation, are responsible before God to serve him. And as we do, we not only allow God's salvation to transform us, but those and the nations around us as well. So let's ask God to give us the strength to be faithful to him. I wonder if Meka noticed what I noticed on the plane in Colombia, that most people don't listen to warnings. Let's be that exception, Kalani. Let's remember. Thanks be to God.